Welcome to the program. How is it possible that a disease we've known how to prevent and cure for over a century still infects 500 million people every year, killing nearly 1 million of them? And at a time when every emergent disease inspires waves of panic, why aren't we doing more to eradicate one of our oldest foes? These are the questions that our guest this morning, journalist Sonia Shah, sets out to answer in her new book, The Fever. Sonia Shah is an investigative journalist. She's the author of the critically acclaimed books, The Body Hunters and Crude. It is my pleasure to have her here to talk about the fever, how malaria has ruled humankind for 500,000 years. Sonia Shah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Why is it that there is suddenly a renewed interest in dealing with the problem of malaria around the world?
I think there's been, there's definitely been a resurgence of new funding for fighting malaria after many decades of being a really kind of a forgotten disease. And it started around the late 90s where people like Bill and Melinda Gates, the Global Fund to Fight TB, Malaria and HIV, a bunch of other NGOs and also state international bodies launched a renewed effort to tackle this disease again. And it's sort of because just the politics are right at this moment, you know, and people realize like this is something that is actually pretty straightforward to do. We can now get these bed nets out to as many people as possible, and that it has been proven to be fairly effective at reducing deaths from malaria. And they're also really easy to distribute. They're really cheap to procure, easy to fundraise for. So it just, you know, a lot of different factors came together to renew interest in this disease. So between like 1998 and today, I think funding has gone from around $100 million a year to fight malaria to about $2 billion a year now. So it's been a huge resurgence in interest in dealing with this.
And how does this break out in terms of those things that are being done to eradicate the disease versus the things like the bed nets impregnated with the various insecticide that is being done to sort of prevent people from getting the disease?
Right. Well, that's a really good question. I mean, it actually, for malaria, it's actually quite different strategies that you use if you want to get rid of the disease, eradicate it completely, or if you want to just reduce the number of people getting sick and getting infected. So those are really different kinds of strategies. And I think what's happening now is we're a little bit conflicted on that. There's a lot of talk about what we need to do is eradicate the disease. But in fact, what we're really doing on the ground is we're just trying to reduce the number of people who get sick or deathly sick from it by distributing bed nets. Bed nets alone are not going to eradicate malaria by any stretch of the imagination.
What are the things that we need to be doing to eradicate the disease in Africa and other places in the world where we have this epidemic?
Well, that's kind of the million-dollar question. Some people think that if you use a number of different methods all at once, so if you give really good drugs, prompt treatment, everyone has a bed net, you do some spraying of the interior of houses with insecticides, like we used to do with DDT, but now with other chemicals as well. You do all of that all at once, and you can actually disrupt transmission. And once you stop that transmission cycle, you can actually, think about eradicating the disease, at least from one local area. But historically, it's taken even more than that. In some places, you can do those multiple lines of attack, and it actually can stop transmission, but in places where malaria is really entrenched, you also have to think about changing the way people live so that they're not exposed to the bites of mosquitoes all the time. And, in parts of Africa where people live in mud huts that they've built themselves and really live lives where they're outdoors a lot, it's going to take a lot more kinds of structural changes in societies to really get rid of malaria for good.
If we look at those things that we've done in the West to essentially eradicate the disease, what can we learn from that experience that's applicable to the Third World?
I think that's such an important thing to do, and I think it's really what's missing from our approach to malaria today. We tried to eradicate malaria worldwide in the 1950s, and when that effort, as it took off, we really stopped surveilling for malaria. We stopped writing about malaria. We stopped understanding the history of malaria. So a whole generation of knowledge about malaria was really lost after that, the DDT era of malaria after World War II. And so we haven't gone back to the lessons from our own history. And the lessons from our own history are that, you know, technology alone isn't enough. We also really need to lift people out of the kinds of impoverished conditions where they are vulnerable to the bites of infected mosquitoes. We need to build the clinics. We need to build the roads. We need to build the schools, get people electricity and good jobs so that they don't have to live near bodies of water and swamplands, which are these marginal areas to live in. You know, all of that is how we got rid of malaria in our own country. And it's a process that took about a century, you know, of these slow changes. We got railroads, we got roads, we uplifted the rural poor in the South with electrification and other economic development projects. And all of that together really helped us conquer our malaria. We got better housing. You know, we started putting screens on our houses and screens on our doors. It's a simple thing, but it makes a huge difference in terms of how vulnerable we are to mosquito bites. So those are the kinds of things that worked for us here. It's not what we're able to do as a campaign in Africa. You know, I mean, for a campaign, you need something simple. You can say one thing, okay, give us $10, we'll get a bed net, you'll save a life. You know, that's the fundraising appeal of the campaign, and we need to do that because otherwise we don't have any money to fight malaria.
How impactful, and I know there's controversy around this, how impactful was the use of DDT in eliminating malaria here in the U.S.?
Malaria was already declining by the time we started doing our DDT blitz here in the States, which was in the early 1950s. By that time, malaria, and there still was malaria in the South, in parts of the rural South in particular, but it had really declined precipitously already because of all the kind of economic changes that I mentioned. Nevertheless, it was a punctuation mark. I mean, we did that, and that really just ended malaria transmission, you know, bring it right down to zero. And that's really crucial because it's sort of like blowing on a flame. You know, you can keep blowing, but unless you blow it out completely, you know, the power, there's always those powers of regeneration are there, and another spark can take that, get that fire going again. So malaria is sort of like that. So I would say it was a dying fire, but DDT really blew that last ember out.
Talk about the evolutionary heritage of the disease, of the mosquito carrying the disease, and how we might be able to approach it from that angle.
There's some interesting work now on kind of using evolution in our favor in fighting this disease. I mean, this is a disease that three creatures have evolved together. So it's not just us and the malaria parasite, but it's our bodies, the malaria parasite, and the malaria mosquito that carries the parasite. So it's this triangle that has evolved together in, you know, many, many millennia and has adapted to lots of different kinds of conditions. There's many different kinds of malaria species of the parasite itself. There's malarias of all kinds of different animals, not just us. There's at least five species of malaria parasites that infect us, and they have very different strategies of how they survive. So it's a very tricky creature. This is something that's deeply embedded in nature and our ecosystems over many, many, many years. So when we fight it, we are fighting against something that wants to survive, you know, and it will fight back, and that's what we've learned again and again. But one interesting approach that has recently emerged is this idea of attacking the mosquito not when it's young, but when it's old, because in fact, for a malarial mosquito to actually transmit malaria, it has to have been alive for over 10 days or so, because that's how long it takes the parasite to develop inside the mosquito. All of our attacks against malaria mosquitoes are sort of, you know, they're just like a barrage of gunfire. It's not surgical. We're not saying, okay, this mosquito at this time, let's target that. We're just putting insecticide everywhere and killing all of them. Well, the mosquito can evolve defenses against that because it wants to survive. But if we only target the old mosquitoes who have already reproduced, those are actually the most dangerous mosquitoes because they're more likely to actually infect people with malaria because the parasite has had time to develop inside them. But if we fight against just the old mosquitoes, then we're using evolution on our side. You know, because the mosquitoes can still, the population can still survive. You know, that's some new approaches that are coming online in that area.
The idea being that the older mosquitoes are a sort of survival of the fittest, and those are the ones you want to attack.
Exactly. Those are the ones you want to attack. And if you do, it's not going to harm the population of mosquitoes generally. So you're not going to trigger the evolution of resistance to that because, all of these mosquitoes would have equal opportunity to reproduce. And in the end, that's sort of the key to what would make a particular mosquito fit to survive or not.
And one of the things you talk about is the fragile environment in which they survive in.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
The fragile environment in which they survive.
Yeah, that's one of the tricky things about malaria is that it relies on a part of the environment that is very mercurial. You know, it's not like grizzly bears live in a certain environment. We can just avoid that environment and not live near the grizzly bears. Alligators live in a certain environment. We can just, avoid those areas. But we can't really avoid areas where malarial mosquitoes can grow because, and we create their own habitats that they like. A lot of these mosquitoes will breed in puddles, in just the margins of a stream, and we can inadvertently create ideal conditions for mosquito breeding just by simple things, digging a few holes. In Panama, they found during the building of the Panama Canal, malaria was a huge problem there. And one of the ways in which mosquito breeding sites were being created was just by animals, like cows and horses, walking in muddy areas. And in those hoof prints, the mosquitoes, the water would collect and the mosquitoes would breed in there, and that was what was causing a lot of the malaria. So, it's such a fragile habitat that they rely on, and we create them all the time. I mean, we build buildings and we create mosquito breeding sites, we dam rivers, we create mosquito breeding sites, just by making the land uneven, you make a few more puddles and you can have a malaria problem.
What more needs to be done with respect to international efforts on the treatment of the disease? We've talked a little bit about prevention. One of the things we know with malaria is that it is curable, that we've had the drugs to cure it for a long time. What more needs to be done in that regard?
Well, we've done a pretty good job of getting the latest and best drugs out there in many malarious countries today. These are drugs based on artemisinin, which is an ancient Chinese herbal remedy, which has been sort of resurrected and made into a modern drug. And this drug is actually effective against all the other drug-resistant types of malaria that are out there. So it's a very good drug, and there's been international subsidies to help African governments buy large quantities of these drugs and distribute them. So that part of and there's still a lot of work to be done on distributing the drugs and getting them into, the dispensaries and clinics where they're needed. But the other big part of the problem is getting people who are sick with malaria to actually get themselves treated. Malaria is really considered a normal part of life for many African families, especially in rural areas. And it's not something that they rush out to the doctor for. There's some estimates that, 9 out of 10 cases of malaria are actually just suffered at home and are never reported and never diagnosed or anything. So that part of the equation we haven't really dealt with, just getting people to actually care enough about their malaria to go get treated.
And is the foundational work that's done by groups like the Gates Foundation and even some of the corporations that have been working on this in Africa, are they addressing this part of the issue as well?
I would say less so. I think it's much easier for us to go in and bring shipments of drugs and donate bed nets and sort of provide commodities to ministries of health and different government bodies. It's much more difficult for us to change the culture on the ground. So there is a little bit of work in that area in terms of raising awareness about malaria and doing educational campaigns. And certainly malarious countries themselves often are doing this all the time, too. But I would say it's really kind of the hardest part of the problem. And I think it's going to take a lot more than just, you know, a few billboards to do it. We're going to, it really means changing people's expectations about their own health.
Is there the danger, because of international travel being as extensive as it is and globalization and everything that goes along with it, of the disease spreading back into places like the U.S.?
I think it absolutely is. I mean, we already have 1,000 or so cases of malaria in the United States every year, you know, these days. And, you know, recently it came out that the CDC, which actually first began as a malaria control organization for the United States, the Centers for Disease Control is what they, you know, their new name now, that they are actually going to be closing the branch of their organization that deals with these mosquito-borne diseases. So if we, and I really feel that surveillance is what has protected us all these years, because we have the malarial mosquitoes, they're all still here, and we have enough people coming into this country who have malaria parasites in their bodies. So if we're not watching for, you know, what we're doing now, which is working, is we're surveilling. So we can see whenever these little flare-ups occur, and we go put them out. You know, and that's really hugely important. But if we stop doing that, I think, you know, all the conditions are there for malaria to return to the United States in terms of the actual, you know, mosquitoes being here and the parasites being here.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you talk about is the work that is being done by various oil companies and mining companies to even address the disease in Africa and other third world locations.
Yeah, they've been really at the forefront in terms of corporate involvement in the fight against malaria, have been the oil companies and the mining companies, particularly those that are active in parts of Africa. This came out of their own efforts. You know, they were going and doing mines and putting up natural gas installations in West Africa and other parts of the malarious parts of Africa, and really suffering a burden of malaria among their own workers. You know, there was a natural gas installation being put out on this island called Bioko Island off Equatorial Guinea, and ExxonMobil had built all these ranch houses on this island for all the Texan workers. They wanted to come, you know, live there with their families and work on this natural gas installation. Well, they were just empty. I mean, they had built all these houses, and it was empty because nobody wanted to come and risk getting bitten by a malarial mosquito. So they've had to do stuff to protect their own workers, and they've learned, as is perfectly logical when you think about it, that okay, they can control malaria for their workers in their one little area, but there's always infected people and infecting mosquitoes which are able to come into that area. So you have to kind of enlarge, you know, the area that you control malaria in. You have to make these ever larger circles going out and out and out. And so that has led them to start partnering up with other organizations that are trying to, you know, fight the disease in a larger area.
As the Chinese take a larger and larger role in Africa, are they addressing this issue at all?
Oh, yeah. The Chinese are doing tons and tons of work around malaria in Africa. There's not that much news about it here in the States, so it's a little hard to really understand the scale of what they're doing. But they've launched some very ambitious projects, actually trying to get rid of malaria completely, like eradicate it from different islands in Africa. They are doing a lot around drug treatment, because artemisinin is originally a Chinese drug, too.
Talk a little bit about Haiti and the dangers that we face in post-quake Haiti right now from malaria.
Well, Haiti is a really interesting example of malaria in the Americas. It's the only Caribbean nation that actually still has falciparum malaria. That is the species of malaria that's much more common in Africa, and it's much more virulent than the other kinds of malaria that that is more commonly found in the tropical Americas. So it's the only place that has falciparum, which is a very deadly kind of malaria, probably responsible for 90% of the deaths from malaria in the world. And so with that parasite roosting on that part of the island, the conditions now are very dangerous, because a lot of people are still homeless, so they're much more vulnerable to the bites of mosquitoes. And, of course, now it's rainy season there. So there's going to be an explosion of malarial mosquitoes, as there is every rainy season. But with the rubble and debris that still hasn't been cleared, and with people very much exposed to the bites of mosquitoes, the aid workers down there are really bracing for a possible malaria outbreak.
What are the dangers of some of the celebrity attention that the disease has gotten and some of the celebrity efforts? Does that have any downside?
I think it does have a downside. I mean, there's pros and cons, but the good thing is that they bring huge amounts of awareness, and they bring, lots of fundraising capabilities with them. The downside is do we start to change the message and change our strategies based on what is easier to fundraise for? And I think we can see that happening a little bit with the focus on this one strategy of bed nets, which has really been a message that has been so simplified. In fact, bed nets, treated bed nets, they cut mortality from in children who use them. Mortality goes down by 20% or so. So that's good. I mean, obviously, any life saved is worth it, but it's not a panacea by any stretch of the imagination. And there's no simple equation of give us $10, we'll buy a bed net and save a child's life. It's really not that simple. A, because they're not as effective as all that, but B, because there's resistance on the ground to actually using them. And that gets back to this idea of, like, what's the culture, what are the cultural conditions that people live in and how do they think about this disease? So what people are finding is, yes, we're sending boatloads of bed nets over to Africa, but people aren't using them. Maybe half of people are saying that they use them, and then again, you have to wonder, you give somebody a gift, and then you go back 6 months later and say, oh, did you use my gift? Well, usually people will say, yes, oh, yes, of course, bring out the old vase that, you got for the Christmas present from your aunt that you always hated. You bring it out, and you say, oh, yes, 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 I have my flowers in it now. Well, it's kind of like that with bed nets, too, so we don't really know how much they're being used. If you look at the medical anthropology around how people actually think about malaria, they think of it as a normal part of life. They consider it a mild illness. They live in huts where it's very difficult to hang these things up. So, what is the likelihood that they're going to go to the level of effort that we want them to go to actually sleep under these nets consistently to gain this 20% advantage? There's also medical anthropology that shows that in a lot of rural areas in Africa, and it was the same here in the United States when we had malaria, people believed that mosquitoes carry malaria, but they also think they can get malaria from lots of other factors like rotten food or working too hard or, any number of other jealousy or, any number of other factors that they believe actually cause malaria as well. So if you think about that, here we are saying, use this bed net, and they're thinking, well, this is a mild disease, B, it's a normal part of life, and C, I could get malaria anyway because it's not just mosquitoes, it's also hard work, rotten food, et cetera, et cetera. And, so you add all that up together, and, the picture around, well, yes, we're doing all this great work getting bed nets out there, but, how much is it really going to change things on the ground? Yeah, I think that's not so clear. Yet at the same time, to go back to your question, the celebrity leadership and the whole fundraising appeal of a bed net is that it is simple. We give them the net, we save the life. And so we've put in a lot of effort to getting these nets out there, but, are we doing the follow-through of education, awareness building, helping people understand the actual, etiology of the disease, et cetera?
Sonia Shah, her book is The Fever, How Malaria Has Ruled Humankind for 500,000 Years. Sonia, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.